Witness 3. Dreams deferred. He's a dreamer. Let us leave him. Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. I woke up screaming her name. Nightmares aren't that unusual for me. After we got our first TV, my parents discovered that I should not watch scary shows. Shows with monsters weren't a good idea, and monsters or no monsters, definitely not The Twilight Zone, even though I really liked that show. Nightmares were bad enough. The problem was that I ended up running down the hallway, yelling and jumping into my parents' bed. That might have been all right for a normal-sized 10-year-old, but at 10, I weighed 100 pounds and was tall for my age. My parents really didn't want me to get that running start before flinging myself into the air to land in the middle of their bed between them. This time was different, though. Now I was 15 and I hadn't watched any scary TV shows. My dream wasn't about monsters, and I didn't go running down the hall to jump in my parents' bed. My dream was about a group of my classmates and me. Six of us were standing together in a storm, swirling all around us. Three of my classmates were on my left and two on my right. We stood there with the wind moving towards us, alive. I thought I could see, yes, there were people in that wind. Seven people? People things? One facing each of us and one extra. In front of me, there was a huge manhole with its cover off to the side. I couldn't tell what was in the manhole, but I felt like I was supposed to know and do something about it. Only, I was too scared to do anything because the people in the wind seemed to ready to attack my friends if I did anything. Those people things in the wind were protecting the manhole. Even as the wind and rain raged all around us, where we stood was quiet and still. The air was heavy. We were just standing there waiting, and just when it seemed something was about to happen, when those people things started moving towards us and somebody started to come from behind us, the dream would fade, and I would wake up moaning with a yell on my lips. I would wake up sweaty and cold, feeling a terrible sense of loss and emptiness. The feeling that we were all going to lose something scared me. What really scared me, though, was that I felt I was going to lose Dolores. I guess that's why I woke up screaming her name. This was the week that Iron Horse had come back to Holy Ghost. It was the week of my nightmares. Each night I saw the same thing. Somehow, I was looking into the future. A future where I could lose my friends. A future where I would lose my friends. Dolores would be first, then Iron Horse, then Earl, Kool-Aid, and Ghost. In my dream, Dolores seemed most important. My brothers thought I was screaming her name for another reason, and they were teasing me and hoping I'd get over her soon so they could sleep the whole night through. It wasn't what they thought, but I was puzzled myself about why I was so disturbed about a dream that made me feel I would lose Dolores. I mean, that had already happened. I really liked Dolores. I thought maybe it was love, and then I thought, what am I talking about? I'm 15. Whatever I felt, though, I really messed it up. I began to notice Dolores when we graduated to ninth grade. I guess that's when I began to notice that girls were girls. But it was a pretty strong noticing with Dolores. I really don't know what changed. I'd known her since first grade. In ninth grade, though, I noticed that she was beautiful. Black hair, thick eyebrows and lashes, a tiny dark mole on her cheek, her pecan brown skin, her littleness, her friendly and gentle way, the way she walked, with her hips showing the slightest movement. She was little and gentle, short and smallish. What caught my attention, almost in one sudden moment, were her eyes and her walk of a woman. We had always talked. Being in the same class with somebody since first grade, it would be hard not to be friends. Now I wanted Dolores to be more than that to me. I started talking to her more and trying to talk to her in a new way. "Hey, Dolores," I would say, trying to make my voice deeper. And that was hard to do. Despite my size, in the choir I still sang tenor. Not just tenor, but first tenor. Sometimes Sister Joanne would ask me to sing the soprano part to help the sopranos hear what they were supposed to sing. I'm no iron horse, that's for sure. "Hey, Dolores," I say in my fig deep voice. "Hey, Robert," she would say with a smile. Then I was stuck. I was flustered. I thought her smile told me she liked me, but I didn't know what else to do. Lost in my own anxiety, I asked her about homework and other things that were just as romantic. We talk, and then it was time for class, and that was it. I wanted to sit with her and eat lunch, but everybody would notice, and I knew I couldn't face any teasing. I didn't know how to ask her for a phone number. I didn't know where she lived. I knew it was out in the country somewhere. That was all I knew. Some of the guys were always talking about girls, talking about sex. I couldn't even talk to Dolores, and they could talk about sex. One thing I knew was that Dolores was not among the girls they could brag about or even lie about. She had no boyfriend, at least not one from our school. I don't think she had a boyfriend at all. I hope she didn't. My mistake happened because I started listening to and believing those guys who talked. I was desperate to learn how to make Dolores my girlfriend, and they had girlfriends and girls who wanted to be their girlfriends. They bragged about a lot of stuff, especially touching girls on the sly. Walking by a girl and brushing against her with their hands, getting a feel, they said. The way they told it, girls didn't seem to mind, especially when guys on the basketball team talked about it. After the game last night, one of them said, "I saw this girl who was something." Etienne went on saying, "When I walked by her, I touched her, and man, she was soft, and she smiled at me. I hope I see her again." "You crazy, man," Larry said. "You should have gotten her number then. Since she smiled, she liked you." My mistake was trying this with Dolores. I bumped into her one day and let my hand touch her hip. She looked at me funny, but didn't say anything. I did it again a couple of days later. This time, in front of everybody, she screamed at me, "What is wrong with you?" Her beautiful eyes now looked at me in a new, intense, ungentle way. I wanted to apologize. I wanted to and didn't know how. Being such a kind person, Dolores never stopped talking to me. She just stopped trusting me. I could tell, and now I was really miserable. I knew then that I did love her, because losing her trust hurt me so bad. After that, I just tried not to bother her. I had already lost Dolores, so why would that part of the dream bother me the way that it did? I didn't tell Iron Horse about my dream of losing Dolores and him and the rest of my friends. Not even after he told me about his memory of something that didn't happen. I was too caught up in trying to understand what he was talking about. "How can you have a memory of something that didn't happen, Iron Horse? I don't understand." "I know," he said. "I told you that it's not making sense to me either. I just remember." "You remember what?" "A civil rights act." "What's a civil rights act?" "So you haven't heard of anything like that. You're the smartest one in our class, Robert, always reading. You usually know about stuff like this." "Look, Iron Horse, I don't know anything about anything you said. What's going on, cousin?" Iron Horse just sat there looking out across the playground, staring, really, at what I didn't know. I decided to wait and see what else he had to say. He surprised me when he said, "I want you to take me to see Mr. Raphael." If anybody else had looked at Einhorst the way I realized I was looking at him now, he would have broken the jaw. Two things saved me, I think. One, I am his cousin. Two, for some reason he needed me. I knew I was right about the broken jaw when I looked down and saw the knots of sweat coming off his shiny, dark-skinned giant fist. Carefully, I started to talk. "Come on, Einhorst. You want me to take you to see Papa Raphael? Come on, you know about him. That's why I want you to take me to him, Robert. People say he can heal, and they say he can tell you things nobody else can tell you." "I know all that, Einhorst. Even Mama says the same thing, and he's her daddy. But even we only go to him for physical healings, not for future telling. Healing is one thing, but future telling is another. Look, Robert, Mr. Raphael might be able to tell me something to help me." "Help with what, Einhorst?" "He might be able to help me understand why I have this memory of something that didn't happen. That Civil Rights Act, I really remember it, Robert." There were tears in his eyes. That scared me. Crying was not something Einhorst ever did, as far as I could believe. Something was really wrong, bad wrong. "I'll have to talk to Mama first to see if it's okay. Tell Cousin Elahi for me, Robert," he said softly. That's how we left it. I don't know which one of us got up first, me or Einhorst. Walking home, I felt a little lost. I really hoped it would rain. The air was heavy. It kind of felt like rain. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. Mama was in the kitchen cutting up a chicken. I could smell the onions, bell peppers, celery, and garlic that she had already chopped up. She had those seasonings all together in a bowl, and the smell was oh so wonderful. Chicken etouffee was my hope, but I wasn't going to pass on smothered chicken or however she cooked it. Mama had that big butcher knife in her hand. She was cutting that chicken up with massive blows. That's no exaggeration. Mama's a big woman, 5'9" and about 190 pounds. She can always get me and my brother's attention, and she can swing a butcher knife. "Look, Sha," Mama was saying, "people from all over is always bothering your papa, asking him for healing potions and all kinds of things, wanting to go in his house so he can touch him or touch a piece of clothes of one of their sick relatives. At his age today, it's too much on him now. And you know how Jimmy is." "His name is Einhorst, Mama," I said. "His name," Mama said slowly, "is James. But I call him Jimmy because his mama does." She said this with ice in her voice and that butcher knife in her hand. I knew better than talking now, so I just stood there with my head down. Mama finished dealing blows to that chicken and then put the pieces and the seasoning and the hot oil sitting in our big black skillet on the stove. "Why he needs to talk to Raphael?"
"He's having dreams, Mama."
"Well, no, not dreams. Memories. Einhorst says he has a memory of something that didn't happen."
"Sure.
What are you trying to say? Dreams but not dreams and memories of things that didn't happen? What's going on with you boys, eh?"
"I don't know, Mama."
"Did you know Einhorst came back to Holy Ghost?
He gave up football.
I don't know why. And he's different. Quieter and even more respectful to the nuns. And this thing with this memory is really bothering him.
He cried, Mama. Einhorst cried."
"Slow down, Shah. You sound like you're going to cry yourself."
"But I still don't think so.
Leave my daddy alone. Your Papa Raphael hasn't been himself lately. I don't know what's wrong. Something's eating away at him. That's all I know. You leave him be. You understand me?"
"Yes, ma'am."
I left the kitchen and went to the room I shared with my brothers, Philip and brother. Neither one was home, so it was quiet in there. Always, when I felt empty like this, I would take out my alto saxophone and practice. For me, playing the saxophone and hearing the music I made with it was almost the same as telling a person what I was feeling. I could get that feeling, too, when I was reading X-Men comics. I believe those mutants would understand how I felt, because they had been alone in their difference until they found each other. But it was music that did it best for me, gave me the sense that I had somebody who would listen to my feelings. After I practiced the pieces for band, I usually tried to play something from the radio. I didn't have any sheet music for any of those songs, so that was a challenge. I wasn't like my brother Philip. I played better with sheet music than by ear. Philip could play up a storm by ear. All I could do by ear was sound like a storm. Today I hoped for better, but didn't get it. Not until I tried Curtis Mayfield's song, People Get Ready. Something about that song made me find the right combination of keys for each note and made me find the right rhythm for the notes. I was amazed at how good I sounded. That made me want to sing the song. I put down my sax and started singing. In my first tenor voice, I sang it loud and clear. I could hear my own feelings in my singing as I sang the song and the singing expressed and listened to my feelings. That's why I played the sax and sang. The music was my only friend sometimes. Later, I turned on the attic fan in the hallway and lay down under the windows in our room. It wasn't summer anymore, but as Daddy would say, it was still Louisiana hot. Quickened by the fan, the breeze pulled in through the windows felt good. I heard the phone ring a couple of times. I closed my eyes and lay there. And then I heard the rain start. Pretty heavy. Pretty quick. It started to sound like a real storm. Heavy rain and a loud whistling wind. I got up and looked out the window. I didn't understand what I saw. There was no rain. No wind. No storm. Dry and quiet is what it was when I looked out. Dry and quiet, the way it had been all day. Not the first time this had happened. I would have my eyes closed and hear what I thought was rain and then a strong wind. But when I was able to look outside, there would be nothing. Nothing. This was starting to scare me. I went in to tell Mama about this. Before I could finish, she said, "You and Jimmy need to go talk to your Papa Raphael." I stood and looked at Mama for a while. I wondered but didn't ask what changed her mind. Then I was walking back to the bedroom. With a shaking in her voice, she said, "Y'all go soon, Shay. Raphael called. Said he needed to see you and them others." "Oh, Mama, I thought you were serious." "I am." "No, you're not. You said Papa called. We all know Papa won't use a phone. He doesn't even have one in his house." "I am serious," she said. There was anger and fear in her voice. "Raphael called me from Miss Edmonia's house and said he need to see you and them others." "You mean Papa used a phone?" "What did I just say, boy?" Witness 4. Friends, Romans, countrymen. What means this shouting? I do fear the people choose Caesar for their king. Brutus, Act 1, Scene 2. If you didn't know better, you would think that Johnny was trying to be cool. By the way he walks, I mean. Sometimes we all forgot what changed the way Johnny walked. It was because we forgot, I guess, that we gave him the nickname Kool-Aid. Before, Johnny used to move faster. Before, he was always running here and there at school and was fast on the basketball court. Before, for a tall and lanky guy, he was quick even playing baseball. All this was before. Before Johnny survived being hit by a car going 60 miles per hour and then being dragged for 100 yards or so. All before. After. When he came back to school, Johnny didn't run here and there. After, Johnny didn't play basketball or baseball at all. After, his left leg almost dragged, except he would pull it quick in his walk to make it keep up. After, with that quick pull, it looked like he was bouncing or hopping on his left side as he walked. After, he looked like he was doing a version of the cool walk, that drag, bounce, drag, bounce, drag, bounce step that the cool brothers did to let you know they were cool and to let you know that they knew they were cool. After, Johnny's walk was almost like that. After, Johnny wasn't walking that way to impress anybody with being cool. After, Johnny walked that way because of the shortened muscle in his leg and steel pins in his knee joint. After, when he came back to school 8 months later, because to us he walked cool, and because he was so soft-spoken, he became Johnny Kool-Aid. After, as time passed, to everybody on the colored side of the walls in Opelousas, all he was or had ever been was Kool-Aid. All this. After. But I wanted him to still be who he was before, Johnny. Just Johnny. That didn't matter, though. I had to call him Kool-Aid like everybody else because that's how he thought of himself after. Cool as Kool-Aid. You gotta be cool, Robert. The women's like that. You get too dramatic. It was Saturday afternoon and Kool-Aid had come over in a cab. Like usual, we were playing 45s on the record player. Kool-Aid was trying to show me how to swing out. It was hard to believe he could dance at all and that he was one of the best in school. His advantage was his messed up leg. No one danced like Kool-Aid. No one could. I was having a hard time, but getting a little better. Then that slow song dropped through the record changer. Then, of course, we took a break from the dancing lesson. Neither one of us was going to slow dance with another guy. That made me wonder how I was ever going to learn to slow dance. I hoped that maybe my sister Eleanor would help me. Hold me, thrill me, kiss me, the Mel Carter song was playing, and coming to my favorite part, with my eyes closed, I let loose and sang along, but they never stood in the dark with you, love. That's when Kool-Aid pushed on my shoulder and said, "You gotta be cool, Robert. The women's like that. You get too dramatic, man." Too dramatic? I was just singing along with the record, man. "Yeah, but you get into it too much. You sound like you believe the words you're singing. But you ain't got no woman. You're gonna go crazy singing songs like that." Earl raised his hand to ask Sister Edward Vincent a question. Monday. Today we were going to start giving out translations of our parts from Julius Caesar. "I don't understand my part, sister. I know it's short, but I don't understand it." "What is giving you trouble, Earl?" "Well, listen to what it says, sister. Beware the fish of March. That's what Soothsayer keeps saying to Caesar, but that's just crazy. Nobody talks about Caesar swimming or nothing. So what fish is Soothsayer talking about?" Edward Vincent had put her hand over her mouth. I think she was trying not to laugh. "Earl, what makes you think that Soothsayer is saying beware the fish of March? You told us to translate our parts, but I didn't know what an ide was. You know, Soothsayer keeps saying beware the ides of March. So I looked up the word ide. The dictionary says an ide is a fish of the carp family. Well, I don't know whether that's something like a mudfish or a catfish. I just know it's a fish. So my translation is beware the fish of March." The Edward Vincent was holding her mouth again. I think Earl was getting mad about being laughed at. "Earl, you looked up eyed." She was getting a hold of herself, still smiling though. "But the word is ides with an S. Ides with an S means a certain day of the month. It's a word that was a common reference among the ancient Romans. That means that Soothsayer was telling Caesar to beware this day in the month of March." "Which day, sister?" Earl asked. In full control now, she said, "Well, for the month of March, the Ides was the 15th day of the month. So if it was this month, September, it would be the 15th too?" "No, no. If I remember correctly, the 15th is the Ides only of March, May, July, and October. For the other months like September, the Ides is the 13th day of the month.
Okay.
So to put soothsayer in my own words, I would say, Caesar, watch out on the 13th of March, man. Watch your back. Or how about I talk to Caesar like it's now, this month, September. Caesar, watch your back on September 13th, man. Watch out now. I guess we'll take either of those, Earl. I'm glad we got you straightened out. We started class that Monday with the translations from the main characters. The Edward Vincent said we would get to Mark Antony's speech later. Okay, let's hear from someone else. Let's see, after Soothsayer, there's some important things said by Cassius and Brutus, James of Straps, and Robert Malvo. I'm sure that they're ready. Ghost and I walked to the front of the class. We had talked over the phone and helped each other a little, since this part was a conversation between the two of us. It was going to be Ghost's fault. My betraying my friend, it was going to be Ghost's fault. I hadn't thought about someone else causing the mess, not until Ghost started telling me about his translation. I saw that Ghost was going to give me the idea. I mean, Cassius was going to give Brutus the idea. The other Vincent was going to read the Shakespeare part before we did our translation of it. She was going to do that before any of us did our translation. She said that would help us all to see how Shakespeare's language could be translated in different ways. At least that's what she hoped would happen, she said. Now she read part of the conversation between Cassius and Brutus, me and Ghost. Cassius speaks. Will you go to see the order of the course? Brutus. Not I. Cassius, I pray you do. Brutus, I am not gamesome. I do lack some part of that quick spirit that is in Antony. Let me not hinder Cassius your desires. I'll leave you. Cassius, Brutus, I do observe you now of late. I have not from your eyes that gentleness and show of love as I want to have. You bear too stubborn and too strange a hand over your friend that loves you. When the Edward Vincent finished reading, she nodded to me and Ghost. We started. Cassius. Ghost. Are you going to go see the parade? Brutus, Robert. No, not me. Ghost. Me, I think you ought to go, me. Robert. I don't like that stuff, Cassius. I'm not like Antony. But don't let me stop you from doing what you want to do, Caesar. Cassius. I'll just be on my way. Ghost hesitated. It was his turn, but he wasn't saying anything. He just stood there looking at the floor. I waited. The class waited. The Edward Vincent spoke. James, she said, go on with your part. You're doing fine. Ghost looked at her, and then he looked at the class, and then he spoke. Slowly, he said, you know, Brutus, lately you don't look at me with the love I need. The Edward Vincent was looking at Ghost, nodding approval. My classmates were horrified, and the class started snickering, then laughing, then howling. Ghost stared off. He stood there and peed on himself. At that point, it was like a riot. Everybody jumped up and pointed, laughed, and screamed, all at the same time. It was like first grade all over again. The Edward Vincent tried to calm us down, but gave up. She sent us all outside for an early recess before lunch. I stayed and tried to talk to Ghost, but he wouldn't talk. As he left the classroom going to the principal's office, he just mumbled, I am a man. I am a man. We didn't go back to Julius Caesar for the rest of the week. We stayed with Shakespeare, but the Edward Vincent talked to us about the poetry and stuff. When we did get back to our parts of Julius Caesar, Kool-Aid was the first to go. Kool-Aid was Casca. The Edward Vincent read the part Kool-Aid was going to translate. Casca. Are you not moved when all the sway of earth shakes like a thing unfirmed? Oh, Cicero, I have seen tempests when the scolding winds have ribbed the knotty oaks, and I have seen the ambitious ocean swell and rage and foam to be exalted with the threatening clouds. But never till tonight, never till now, did I go through a tempest dropping fire. Either there is civil strife in heaven, or else the world, too saucy with the gods, incenses them to send destruction. Kool-Aid started walking from the back where he sat in every class. It was that drag, bounce walk of his. When he got to the front of the classroom, Kool-Aid went over to the Edward Vincent's quiet corner. This was where she sat while we took exams. I think she sat there and prayed sometimes, too. Without asking permission, Kool-Aid sat down in Sister's very comfortable, big living room chair. Then, slow and deliberate, he crossed his legs, put his head back, and, speaking easy, said, "Don't it bother you? When everything is shaking like the ground and lost its mind, like there's nothing holding it in place?" Kool-Aid uncrossed his legs, leaned forward. "Look here, Cicero. I've been seeing ghosts. When the hard winds blows through the pecan trees, I've been seeing the swamps overflowing foam like they wants to be like clouds." Kool-Aid paused, leaned back, and pulled out a cigar, bit the tip off, and spit. The Edward Vincent had to shush the class. "But it wasn't till tonight, not till tonight, that I had walked through a fiery rain. Man, either there's a war in heaven, or we've been too disrespectful to God. And now, he wants to kill us all, the way we always wants to kill them mosquitoes." Cool. The slow, careful way he said all this was cool. Sitting in Sister's chair, pulling out that cigar, oh man! And the Edward Vincent liked it. She applauded and smiled. We were all shocked, though, that she didn't have a sister fit about that cigar. But she did stop Kool-Aid on his way back to his desk, shook his hand, and took the cigar. Even that was Kool-Aid's moment, because when the Edward Vincent reached for the cigar, Kool-Aid leaned towards her, kissed her on the cheek, and said, "Don't it bother you when everything is shaking like the ground that lost its mind?" She had to shush us again. Dolores and Iron Horse would be coming up now, Calpurnia and Caesar. Calpurnia was Caesar's wife. The Edward Vincent waited until we really settled down before she read the part. It was hard, though. Kool-Aid had been so cool. Calpurnia speaks. Sister is reading. "What mean you, Caesar? Think you to walk forth? You shall not stir out of your house today, Caesar. Caesar shall forth. The things that threaten me ne'er look but on my back. When they shall see the face of Caesar, they are vanished." Calpurnia. "Caesar, I never stood on ceremonies, yet now they frighten me. There is one within. Besides the things that we have heard and seen, recounts most horrid sights seen by the watch. A lioness had whelped in the streets, and graves have yawned and yielded up their dead. Fierce, fiery warriors fight upon the clouds, in ranks and squadrons and right form of war, which drizzle blood upon the capital. The noise of battle hurtled in the air. Horses did neigh, and dying men did groan, and ghosts did shriek and squeal about the streets. Oh, Caesar, these things are beyond all use, and I do fear them." Caesar. "What can be avoided? Whose end is purposed by the mighty gods? Yet Caesar shall forth, for these predictions are to the world in general as to Caesar." Calpurnia. "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of a prince." Caesar. "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once. Of all the wonders that I yet heard, it seems to me most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, a necessary end, will come when it will come." After a pause to look the room over, to make sure we would be listening, the Edward Vincent gave Dolores and Iron Horse the nod to begin. Calpurnia, Dolores.
What are you talking about, Caesar? You're not thinking of going out in that swamp? Oh, no, you are not leaving this house today.
Caesar, Iron Horse. I'm going. Everything that's ever been against me always talk behind my back. When I face them, they just goes away.
Dolores.
Caesar!
I've never been a believer in voodoo, but today the signs scare me. Somebody came by to tell me about some strange things they saw on the streets today. Things that are different than anything we have seen or heard before. They say a gator gave birth down the street here in Opelousas. They say tombs have been opening up and the dead have gotten up. They say that there is a war happening on the clouds between two armies of fiery soldiers and that their blood is dripping down on the parish courthouse. They say you can hear the battle in the air, horses crying out, dying men groaning loudly. They even say that there are ghosts screaming and yelling down the streets, "Come on, Caesar." These are strange things, and I am afraid.
Iron Horse. Oh, Calpurnia, we can't avoid nothing once a gree-gree has been set. So I'm going out today. Those predictions applies to everybody, not just me, Caesar.
Dolores. Oh, Caesar. Beggars die all the time without comets showing up. Right now, the sky tells of the death of a Mardi Gras king.
Iron Horse.
Calpurnia, you know cowards die a lot before they really die. The brave only dies once. Of everything I've ever heard, the strangest is all the people who fear dying. Something that's gotta happen.
There was quiet when they finished. And they stayed up front looking at each other. Some of us began to applaud Iron Horse and Dolores. I don't think we were applauding because they got through their lines. Something was happening between them, through their parts. The way they looked at each other was, well, it was... I think we were applauding the feeling they made happen for the class, the feeling they gave those of us watching and listening, a feeling of maybe a kind of... some kind of connection. Maybe what Brutus called kinship. I don't know what to call it. I just know it was there in our classroom, coming through them.